to say a word about Sefer Vayikra before we start. And we mentioned a little bit in Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh that it's a special opportunity when learning Sefer Vayikra that as much as we don't feel automatically the same kind of connection to what's going on here, but this is a major part of the Torah which specifically we relate to through Limud right now. And the notion of Nesham Leparim Sfaseinu, that in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, so we derive our connection to the Korbanos through learning about them. It's a machlokas whether this is something which is relevant to any din in the Torah. We say that if you're stuck on a desert island on Pesach and you don't have any matzah, should you use the Shulchan Aruch to learn Hilchas Matzah and Biyotze that way? Is that the idea? I mentioned to somebody yesterday the whole point that we were talking about the Tosefta, if a person is stuck on the boat and has to get rid of their chametz. So the question came up, well, so what do they eat on the boat? They don't have any food left, and baking matzah on a boat is probably also hard to imagine. So what would happen? That's the second half of that story. So what would happen once you got rid of your chametz? So if you can't fulfill any of the mitzvos that are active on Pesach because you don't have anything with you on the boat, so is there an Indian that you can learn about it and have that count? So that's a little bit the question here. Is this an idea that is specific to Korbanos, that by learning about the Korbanos you are yotze them? Or is the idea that, no, any mitzvah that you can't fulfill directly, you can learn about it, and that's good also. So many thought this was an idea that was specific to Korbanos. The Chafetz Chaim has this discussion in the beginning of his Sefer Likutei Halachos. It's not always well known that the Chafetz Chaim wrote essentially a Mishneh Berurah type Sefer on Kedushin also, the Likutei Halachos. And there he goes through the unique importance of learning Kedushin. I don't remember if we discussed this a few weeks ago about these differences, but it also comes up in the question of the organization of the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi. Now we know that the Talmud Yerushalmi, for example, has Gemaras on Zeroyim, while the Talmud Bavli doesn't. And the reason being that in Eretz Yisrael they dealt with Zeroyim issues all the time, so they had what to write about it, and in the context of Chutzlars, they weren't dealing with Zeroyim, so you don't have Gemaras on Zeroyim, and you don't have Gemaras on Taras. But they weren't dealing with Kedushim either, and yet you do have a Bavli on Kedushim. Ironically, we have a Bavli and not a Yerushalmi. In Yerushalmi, there was a whole topic of a whole story, there was a hoax, there was a fake Yerushalmi that was claimed to have been discovered, and it was a whole discussion, a number of Rabbanim, the lid of the Great Gedolim, considered it possibly. There's a whole book written about it. You have to admire the type of pranks people were capable of at that time. That to actually falsify a Seder of Shas is not a small thing. But Lamaisa, we have a Bavli on Kedushin and not a Yerushalmi on Kedushin. So why do we have a Bavli on Kedushin if we don't have a Bavli on Taras? I don't have a Bavli on Zeroyim. So it seems to perhaps reflect this idea that specifically by Kedushin, there is a notion that even when we can't perform it directly, we should still try to be involved in the issues to the extent that we can and study them. And perhaps there's a couple of reasons why that's true when it comes to Korbanos. One is that the whole nature of a Korban is to bring yourself closer to God. And Talmud Torah is also about bringing yourself closer to God. That's why Talmud Torah is a venue for tshuva, it seems like, from the language of the Rambam, because chait is about distancing yourself from God, and Talmud Torah brings you closer. So it's a method of tshuva. So there is a strong connection between Korbanos and Talmud Torah. This was something we spoke about in the Kol Elyon, the first journal for the Kol Elyon, the Kol Tzvi, was on Zvachim. So I talked about this in the introduction, how there's a unique role for learning and Kedushin. And also, another reason why it's especially important that we learn it, and this is also relevant to this Aliyah specifically, is that the Korbanos, in large part, serve as a kapara. serve as a method of atonement. And if we don't have the avenue of actually bringing the carbon, so then to learn to the extent that it counts as the carbon, we need a kapara, so it's important. But also, there's all kinds of imagery, as we've mentioned, that is contained in these dinim. And if we are able to carry out the mitzvah, so then we're confronted with the imagery, and hopefully we'll also think about the imagery, and it will contribute to our kapara. But if we're not actually carrying out the dinim, then all the more so, we can still study the concepts, try to understand the imagery, and that contributes also to our ability to atone for whatever needs to be fixed. So there's a tremendous value to these parshios, to be able to contemplate what they mean and to try to understand the implications. In general, it's also a well-known machlokas among the Rishonim as to what was the purpose of Karbanos in general, the whole notion of animal sacrifice in Judaism, how exactly does that fit in hashgafically. The Rambam is often associated with a position that's sometimes a little bit misquoted, so to try to say it in a more general way, that the Rambam sounds like Karbanos were not necessarily inherently a part of the Torah's vision, but that it has something to do with a response to the practices of the cultures of the world. So either that means that Jews were familiar with animal sacrifice and therefore it was necessary to have some degree of that type of practice in order to be a system that they could relate to, or as the Rambam actually says, that the non-Jews were worshipping animals such as cows, for example, or lambs, and therefore the fact that we sacrifice these animals is essentially an act of conquering the Avodah Zarah. But either way, it sounds as if the Karbanos are not really there for their own reasons, but they're there because it's a reaction on one level or another to what's happening in the other religions of the world, which brings up the broader question of what's the role of Karbanos in the future, of animal sacrifices in the third Beis HaMikdash. So here the Rambam presumably, despite whatever philosophical reason he associates with it, presumably sees that as a part of the picture, because he only brings in Mishnah Torah that which is going to be relevant in future generations. He doesn't record things in Mishnah Torah that were only relevant in the past and are not going to be relevant in the future. Rav Kook is quoted as having maintained that L'Asad Lavo, we're only going to have Menachos, we're not going to have animal Korbanos, and that's the idea of Arva L'Hashem Minchas Yehuda B'Yerushalayim, and there's much debate about that. But in any event, so the question of what role do they have as far as how did they get there in the first place, so the Ramban has a very different understanding than the Rambam's position, and the Ramban understands that they are fundamentally a part of the Torah's vision, and that it basically is a proxy, that especially when we're talking about in a reaction to sin, so the notion is that really a person should feel as if he should be shechted, he should be brought up as a korban, and it's the chesed rigon shalom that he allows it to happen through an animal instead. And so we're supposed to consider what's happening to this animal and imagine that this could have been him, and that should contribute to the kapara process. So one way or another, we don't have the actual carrying out of these things, but we do have today, we have the themes, we have the psukim, and to be able to study them and to be able to learn them is our method of coming closer to these concepts. Okay, so to look at the psukim in Shishi, this begins with the end of Parak Dalet, Pasuk Chav Zayin, it goes into the beginning of Parak Hay. So the pasuk begins, V'yem nefesh achas techa tebishgaga, me'yam ha'aretz, ba'asos achas mitzvos Hashem, asher lo se'asena v'ashem. So let's say somebody does an Avera, doesn't do the Avera on purpose, he does the Avera b'shogeg. He does an Avera on purpose, so then there is a punishment. So in this case, a punishment of kares. But if he does it b'shogeg, so then it's not like you're off scot-free, but there is still an inyan of a kapara if somebody does such things. There is a machlokas, I think we touched upon, for example, this week, talking about the difference between deraisas and derabbanans. So the idea of a kapara that you need for an issur d'oraisa, it's a question whether there is a parallel concept for a drabana. That if you do an avera d'oraisa, so then in some cases we find that there's what to talk about as a kapara, as we see here. But when it comes to a drabanan, so the Nesibas HaMishpat has an often cited opinion that there's no need for a kapara if the avera is done b'shogeg. And the explanation that the later Svarim have to go with that Nesivos correlates to what we were talking about this week when we were talking about Haramas by Dinim D'Oraisa and Dinim D'Rabbanan, that it could be that the whole relationship we have to a Din D'Rabbanan is that it's a notion that we have to be compliant with rabbinic law. We can't rebel against rabbinic law. So therefore, if one is acting b'shogeg, so then you're not rebelling. When it comes to a Din D'Oraisa, there's something inherent that's negative about whatever we're talking about. So if you violated even b'shogeg, so then there is a need to have some type of a rectification. But when it comes to an Aveira D'Rabbanan, the whole point is that it's there not because of its own reasons, as we discussed, but there to perhaps create a buffer between this and actual Aveira Minatora. And therefore, it doesn't have its own weight to it. It's not going to leave a spiritual stain. And the main point is that you should be compliant. So if you're acting b'shogeg, you're compliant. You didn't know you were doing anything wrong. So that should require a kapara. That's how many understand the nesivos. Hi.
It wouldn't be like a violation of the d'oraisa listening to the rabbanan b'shogeg.
So the question is there such a thing? The whole nature is, right, just to say in different terms, like it's to talk about, and it's not a good example of Nisakaris, but say, let's say Chametz on Pesach, right? So say that Chametz on Pesach has a spiritual stain. The Torah does not want you eating Chametz on Pesach because it is harmful spiritually. So if you choose to eat it knowingly, then you are both violating the commandment of God and coming into contact with a spiritually harmful force. When it comes to something that's Drabbanan, so the whole nature of it is not that there's anything dangerous here for you. It's that you are disobeying the rabbinic command. So if you don't know that you're disobeying the rabbinic command, you're not disobeying the rabbinic command. It's all defined by your compliance. So that's not an act of lo sasser, if you don't know that what you're doing is in defiance. That's the general explanation. Not everybody agreed with this. Like we've mentioned, there was Joseph Engel disagrees with this whole approach because he believes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu signs off on the Dinim D'Rabbanan, so they become endorsed after the fact. So Dinim D'Rabbanan essentially become like Dinim D'Oraisa in terms of having inherent components in them. But then he followed this idea, which is an interpretation of the Nesivos, and this concept that the Rabbanans are fundamentally different, and therefore the whole notion of a kapara doesn't apply. Is that the same thing as saying there's no need to do tshuva? Not necessarily. There's discussion about this in various forums, just exactly what the implications are. There's a lot that's built onto this position of the Nesivos. It's a little bit of a question just how far to go with it. But in any event, so here, this concept of the chet v'shogeg, so Shem Shem Fal Hirsch, emphasizes here that the chattas of the individual and the chattas of the nasi, the king, are basically the same. Right? Because as an obligation to adhere to the mitzvahs of the Torah, we're all equal. The only difference is the type of the animal. So the seir is supposed to represent a certain prominent communal role, so that's what the nasi brings, and it's different than what the individual brings. But the idea that there is an accountability for sin, that's true for everyone. It's true whether you're a yachid or it's true whether you're the king. In fact, the Yaznayim Torah points out that actually the liability is really greater if you're the king, and he says that's the reference here, that it says nefesh achas. That's the difference. So why does it say nefesh achas? Because an individual can be a nefesh achas. He can be somebody by himself. But a king, whatever he does, has an influence on everybody. So therefore, he's not called a nefesh achas. And that's one of the distinctions that bears out here, even though essentially the structure is the same. Just to mention a huge halachic issue, so there is another drasha on the pasuk of nefesh achas, The Gemara has in a few places in Masechta Shabbos that this is the theme, this is the idea of Shnayim Shasol Pturim, which is a whole sugya, which is a fascinating sugya in itself, just to mention some of the highlights, that there is a din that if you do a malacha on Shabbos, let's say you carry something on Shabbos, that's the context of how the Gemara has it in the first parak of Shabbos. So let's say you carry something on Shabbos, but you carry it with someone else. Two people do the maisa together. So that's called shnayim shaso, and that's a ptur. Now, the ptur is derived from this pasuk. This nefesh achas, that's the drasha the Gemara has to derive the ptur. Although it's not clear, some understand that it's more of a svara, and some understand that it is associated with the pasuk, and that's relevant to understanding the nature of the din. But just in terms of the details, so when we say that you're pater, we're assuming it's a one-person job. That let's say if you have two people who are carrying a sofa in Rosh Hashanah on Shabbos, so then they're both going to be chayiv, because it's normal for a sofa to be carried by two people. But let's say you have a book, you know, something that normally a person could carry by himself, and he carries with someone else, so that's artificial, so that's not a normal way for something to be carried. So we have a drasha that there's a p'tur then, that's called Shnayim Shasol. There's a whole discussion of Gemara back and forth. What if the two people are of varying strength? So one person could carry it by himself, and he doesn't really need the other guy, but the other guy couldn't carry it by himself, and he does need the first guy, so it's one chayiv, it's one pater. That's a whole discussion of the Gemara, and it's also a discussion of the later Svarim. So what if you have two people who are both necessary, but one person, let's say one person isn't Jewish, one person isn't subject to Hilchos Shabbos. So does that matter? Are we talking about Davka, the fact that we're splitting the Malacha in terms of the Aveira between two people, or is it that we are splitting the activity between two people? Is it that this is something unnatural and that's why it's a Ptur? It's basically a Kala'ach Yad kind of thing, or is it a Malachas Machshevas kind of thing, or is it something inherent? So there's a big discussion. Yosef Engel actually has a tshuva about this in his Ben Poras, where he discusses the question of A, does this apply to other concepts outside of Shabbos? The Bechor Shor, we mentioned in the context of Chametz the other day, has a discussion about whether this applies to Shchita L'Avodah Zarah. So does this apply to other Averos? Does it apply to mitzvahs? What if you do a mitzvah with somebody else's artificial help? Is that called a mitzvah? So many different spheres of application. Does it apply to other mitzvahs? Does it apply to mitzvahs? Does it apply to other Averos? Or even more fundamentally to that, is it just about onesh, or is it about the whole thing? So if you do a halacha on Shabbos with someone else like this, should we say that it's mutter minat Torah? It's asur midrabanan for sure, but should we say that it's mutter minat Torah? Or is it asur minat Torah and just a question of onesh? All of this is discussed. All of these are open shilas. And Rav Shechter has an essay about this in Eretz Tzvi where he points out that it's interesting to say that it only applies to Shabbos. Well, this pasuk is not about Shabbos in the first place. And so, why should we assume that the pasuk is telling us about Shabbos? So he suggests that the idea is that it's talking about what's defining a maisa. Is it considered to be a maisa if you do it together with someone else? So that has implications for Shabbos and implications for the chiyuv and a korban, and that's how essentially the discussion unfolds from there. So he has a discussion based on that, on what the different implications are. He assumes that it doesn't necessarily create an Isser even on Shabbos or especially on Yontif, because it's really about the Ptur. And this also probably connects to the fact that if you want to say that it's specifically about Shabbos, that Shabbos, maybe we've mentioned in the past, is uniquely Maisa defined. That Shabbos is probably not about the result of the malacha happening, but it's about that you are not supposed to be doing the malacha on Shabbos. You're not supposed to be doing the maisa of the malacha. So it could be that Shabbos specifically, if you're splitting the maisa with somebody else, even though it's actually happening, maybe that's not called the isser of doing the malacha on Shabbos as opposed to other things. So the Sefer Achinuch, the Minchas Chinuch rather, has a suffix about what if you cook kvas b'chalav and you do that together with somebody else. So it could be that separate from the question of whether this idea of Shnayim Shasol applies to other dinim, that maybe it depends whether it's a din in the maisa or a din in the result. That when it's a din in the result, then it shouldn't matter how you're doing it. So basa b'chalav, if we discussed the other day, right, the basa b'chalav, bishul basa b'chalav might be a siag, you shouldn't create basa b'chalav so that you shouldn't come to eat it. So then you don't really care if you share the maisa with somebody else, the maisa you're creating it. But when it comes to Shabbos, it could be that Shabbos is specifically about how you do a maisa, and therefore it's not necessarily going to be comparable to other things. You're going to have a tour of Shnayim Shaso that's not going to carry out in other contexts. Okay, so let's try to go a little further, get past the first pasuk. So the second pasuk in Eliyah says, "Ohodah ilal chatas v'asher chata v'hevi karbanos iras izim t'mima nekeva al chatas v'asher chata." So if his aver comes to his knowledge, then he should bring a karban. He should bring a iras izim t'mima, female, on the chatas that he did. V'samach asyado al rosh chatas v'shachatas chatas b'makom ha'ola, and he should do smicha on the chatas. He should lay his hands, and he should shecht the chatas in the place of the olah. So this is the din of smicha, that when you do bring a carbon, you're supposed to lay your hands with strength, with your kol kocho, on the animal. This is the original smicha controversy for women, because the Gemara talks about, if you don't know the context of the Gemara, it's very easy to quote it out of context, but when the Gemara most explicitly talks about nashim and smicha, it's talking about this concept of smicha, because technically women are pturis from this smicha. And if they're pturos, it's a question, then can it be done voluntarily? Because it sounds like it's ishtamshus pekudshim, it sounds like it's use that is not for the purpose of the mitzvah with a korban. So it's a discussion in the Gemara whether we say nashim somchos rishus or not. Are women, when they bring a korban, are they permitted to do smicha in light of that? And that needs a lot of possible out-of-context quotations, if that's where you want to go. But the next pasuk says, "V'lokach haKohen midama be'etzba'o, v'nasan al karnos mizbach ha'ola, v'es kol dama yishpoch le'yisod ha'mizbeach." And the Kohen shall take the blood from his finger, and he puts it on the corners of the mizbeach ha'ola, and he pours out all the blood on the yisod of the mizbeach, on the bottom of the mizbeach. Here, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a comment in his Daras Moshe, which also goes to the whole heart of trying to understand the way the karbanos are structured. So why is it that the karban usher, he brings his karban on the top and the ani on the bottom? What exactly is the message there? So he suggests that there is a difference in terms of what brought about the aver in the first place. So why is the usher most likely to sin? The usher is likely to sin because he forgets God exists. So therefore he gets all involved in his power and his influence, and he forgets that God is there. So therefore he needs to be reminded, he needs to be closer to Shemayim, to understand that God is there. While the Ani is the opposite. The Ani doesn't forget about God, the Ani is mad at God because of his station in life. So therefore he needs to be closer to the ground, so to speak, to appreciate that he's here, he has life, and he should appreciate all the brachos that he has, and he shouldn't feel that he has tainas on the Ribono Shel, which is a point that we'll return to in a minute. Okay, so the next pasuk, there's a lot to say about, the time's not going to permit us to say it. I'll just give you a mar mokum here. I'm going to say a little bit. But the pasuk here says, V'nefesh kisechta v'shama kol Allah v'huei ora u'yada lo yagiv v'nasa avonos. So let's say somebody did another infraction. What did he do? That he heard, he was brought to swear about a matter of testimony that he has knowledge of something, something that he saw or he knew about, and he doesn't give the edus. So then he has to bring a kapar. So there's a lot interesting to be said about this pasuk. Unfortunately, I don't have time to say it all. We'll give you a ma'ar makom. The safer part is Yosef, which I've mentioned many times in the past. So the Paras Yosef was expanded and added to in the contemporary era by Rabbi David Mandelbaum. It was a fascinating Tanakhotim. I heard he just gave a shir last night in the Mizrach of Woodmere. And he has published many, many, many svarim. So he took the original Paras Yosef that was on Bereishis Shmos and Vayikra and republished it and expanded it, and then he wrote his own version for Bar and Dvarim. So in Vayikra, it was part of the original, but he also adds a lot. So there's always a lot in the Paris Yosef. You can tend to have a lot of information and a lot of comments. So it happens to be on this Pasuk alone, Parakei Pasuk Aleph, he has more than 45 pages. So if you really want to explore a lot of what there is to say about this notion, you can have a lot of Shabbos reading if you get a copy of the Paris Yosef from Vayikra. So, but this Pasuk tells us that there is a chiyuv testimony, that when you know something and you're able to provide help for somebody with edus, so then you have to do it. Some of the Rishonim say that we have to figure out, we'll mention in a moment, when this applies and when it doesn't apply as a din. Some of the Rishonim say that even if it doesn't actually apply as a din, in whatever circumstance it is, this is still an example of chesed, that if it's possible for you to help somebody out who needs your support, then it needs your Bezdin endorsement, so then it's still a chesed to do it. But in any event, when does it apply even a din? So first of all, well, who aid? So normally the din aid, when the Torah says aid, even though it's singular, the Gemara says usually it means rabbin, it means two aidim. That aidus only exists with two aidim, so therefore aid is a reference to two. So it sounds like you're a part of a group of two aidim, and that's what we're talking about. So nonetheless, the Rambam says there is an isser here if for an aid echad. If for some things, an aid echad is able to make a difference. So for example, an aid echad can force a shvua in a mominous case. You need two aidim in order to extract money, but if you have one aid, you can force a shvua. So if that's going to help, so in a situation where one aid will make a difference, so then he assumes that there is this mandate by one aid also. Gemara says in Psachim that when you have, let's say, some type of Maisa Isser that you want to testify about, so if you only have one aid, you don't have two, so then it's Dam Lashon Hara. And the Gemara gives a case of somebody who came to give aid just by himself in a situation where you need two, and they gave him Malchus because he said he was in violation of something. When that Torah, he's basically just speaking Lashon Hara because there's no toelas for him to give aid just where it's not going to make a difference. So in some situations, one aid can't do anything. In some situations, one aid can. So the Rambam's position seems to be that when it's one aid, there is theoretically a concept of this Isser. So says it would also apply, for example, to a Kohen or a Apostle in a situation where they accept a Kohen or Apostle. That if you have a circumstance where somebody normally wouldn't be able to help, but he can't help because they were Mekabel him, so then again, there is this concept. The Mishnas Chinuch discusses it also by the concept of Isurin. It says that we have a notion of Eid Echad Bisurin, so if you don't give Eidus, so then you should be liable here for that too. So others disagree. The Shulchan Aruch Teres Chachamim disagrees with that because he notes that the context is the Benot L'Chavero context. It says that you're helping your friend, so it's not stam about any din in the Torah, but it's specifically about where you can help somebody in Beis Din, where he's in a fight with somebody. So that's where you have this notion. So there is a very interesting comment of the Znaim Torah. It's always, the Znaim Torah always has a beautiful drush. You have to figure out how exactly it matches, but its point is well taken one way or another. He says, if the Torah is trying to say here that there's a mitzvah to testify, so why doesn't it just say out, say straight out, it's a mitzvah to testify? Why does it say you are obligated to give edus? Why is the language kind of roundabout? Oh, if he doesn't give the edus, so this is what happens. So what I said about it not fitting, is because, so does that make it more chamer or less chamer? It sounds here like we're saying it's actually worse, that we treat it like an avera. We treat the failure to testify, and that is a bitul asay, but as an avera, that means a kapara. But he's coming from the assumption that there's something here a little bit less chamer, that the fact that Torah doesn't just say you have a mitzvah to testify straight out, that there's some type of message that's being conveyed by doing it like that. And he suggests that the Torah is basically being sympathetic to human nature. And we know that it's very hard to get involved in other people's machlokas. And we know that nobody wants to get pulled into a fight if they don't need to. I mentioned to my other class, my ethics class the other day, about how, you know, it's one thing, the issue of cheating that we have as a matter of school policy and halacha, But on top of that, there's also an obligation to turn in cheaters. That becomes very difficult on an interpersonal level to get involved with testifying against somebody else. That's essentially what's going to happen here. It's a fight between two people. So you're testifying against somebody. And if that's true, it's hard for people to do that. So it says the Torah has rachmanis on this, that we don't state, we recognize that something has to be done because you're letting people lose out by not coming and saying what you know. But at the same time, we don't phrase it as a straight-out mitzvah. And the kapara is relatively straightforward, is relatively simple. So again, you can take your pick as to what you want to emphasize in this pasuk, the fact that there is a apparent avera with a kapara, should that make it worse? Or the angle that he's putting on it, that it's actually less chumer, that the kapara is minor, and that the Torah doesn't use it as a straight sivui, straight out. You kind of have to figure it out from the consequence. Okay. Nefesh asher tiga b'chol davar tamei, or b'nivlas chayet tamei, or b'nivlas behemet tamei, or b'nivlas sheres tamei, v'nela mimenu v'tamei v'ashem. Well, what happens if you touch something that is tamei, whether it's nivlas chayet tamei, or nivlas behemet tamei, or sheres, all of that, then you become tamei. And okiyiga b'tumas adam b'chol tumas, or sheyit m'ba v'nela mimenu v'yad v'ashem, or you become tamei through a person. So for two also, so this is the system that we have. O nefesh kishi shava levateis fasayim lahara olahetiv v'chol asher yivateh ha'adam b'shvua v'nela mimenu v'yadav Hashem machiz me'elo. Or you have this kapara also if you fail to live up to a shvua. So this language of lahara olahetiv basically means to do or to not do. If you learn Masech Shvua, so at the very beginning of Shvua, the Mishnah says, Shvua Shtayim Shem Arba, there's two different types of Shvua, which basically break down into four different types of Shvua. So it uses this Lashon of Lahara Lahetev to do bad, to do or to not do, essentially. How these are the different categories of Shvua. I think Lefian Yustaiti, that's the longest tangent in Shas, by the way, because the Mishnah begins off talking about Shvua Shtayim Shem Arba, and then the Mishnah says, oh yeah, when you're talking about Shtayim Shem Arba, so there's a similar structure in Tuma, and there's two entire prakim about Tuma after that, before it gets back to Shvua. So if you learn, God willing, you should learn Masech Shvua. It's a beautiful Masech, it's really broken up into three Masechtas, because the third part of Shvua is Yeridei, is like Nedarim. From the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th prakim, those are Bav Metzia, that's about Bezdin Shuas. And the first two prakim are all Tumu V'tara. The Beis HaMikdash Sugi is all there. I think of the Fiyanis Daiti, it's the longest tangent in Shas, because the Shtayim Shem Arba gets into that whole discussion. Okay, in any event, so that's that. V'haya ki Hashem v'achas me'ela v'hisvada asher chato alel. So if he has any one of these problems, he has to vidu it. That's a part of the process. V'hevi yas asher v'ashem v'chatos asher chato nekevim v'natzon kispo osir as izim v'chatos v'chipar v'chayim v'chatoso. So then he has to bring his korban for the kapara. He should bring a female from the flock or osir as izim. And Kohen shall make from kapara v'im lo sagi yado desa behavi as Hashem or Asher Chatah Shtei Storim or Shtei Bnei Yovel Hashem Echal Chatis v'Echal Olo. So what if you can't afford that? So we have the concept of the Olo V'Yorei, that if it's too much, so we have a sliding scale, and you can bring this alternative choice, which is two birds. Shnei Sorim, O Shnei Bnei Yonah, one's a Chatas and one's an Olus. So this is a discussion of the Rishonim. Why exactly is this true? Because now you have a Ola here, which is completely burnt, so why is the Ola replacing a Chatas? So that's a different focus. So the Ibn Ezra has two comments here. They're both interesting. So one comment he has is that the Ani has an extra Kapara he needs here. That he has to bring an Ola because maybe while he's doing this, maybe while he is doing this adjusted carbon, so then he has to bring something else because maybe he has a machshava against the Kadosh Baruch Hu at this time. Maybe he has tarumus against God because he's realizing, look at his station in life. He's in this lower position. He has to do the cheapo carbon. So maybe he's going to feel angry, so he has to bring a kapara for that, which is a very interesting idea, especially because as the Chidah notes, so what about the Dali Dalas? He's the really poor, so he should for sure have to do this, but how come you don't find that? You assume that only the regular Ani is going to have these machshavas. So basically what the Chidah says is that if Hashem Baruch Hu has Rachmanis on the Dali Dalas, on the poorest person, because his matzav is so low, so then it's kind of understandable. So it's a fascinating psychological insight here that, you know, on the one hand, sometimes people have this tendency to complain about their fate and to be angry at Hashem Baruch Hu, and sometimes we can sympathize, we can say it's understandable because you're really in such a difficult position. And sometimes we'll say that, look, you should appreciate that there are people who are worse off than you, and to whatever extent you have these tainas, that's something you have to bring a kapara for, because that's not an appropriate attitude. The other answer that the Ibn Ezra has is also interesting from a Kutchin perspective, and there's some svarim who discuss this answer of the Ibn Ezra as a lumdus in terms of how the Kutchin here works out, that there's a replacement here also for the Imurim, because the Imurim of the regular Karban Chatas would have been Kubo Kavo, would have been treated like an Ola. So therefore, essentially, the Ola that Ani brings is to replace the Imurim. So basically what that means is the two birds are really one, that it's really one Karban that is being brought here in two halves, and that's the symbolism here, and that has all kinds of nafkaminas as far as Kutchin is concerned, as far as understanding exactly how that applies. Okay, so there's more to say, but we'll have to pick up later. So God willing, on Sunday we have another Q&A. Is that our decision? Okay, so we have a share, hopefully one